Let me introduce the study, and we'll talk a lot more about what the nature of that study is. But I want to introduce it without telling you the direction, the exact direction we're trying to head. Let me ask you this question. Why did the Lord build the church? Now, there are 25 correct answers to that. I've taught in schools of preaching, and I've taught in Christian schools, and if I ask a bad question and you give any answer that is a true answer, I probably would count it right and then mark off on my inability to ask the questions. But you know, folks don't know why he built the church. If you ask people in this community and in other communities, what's church all about? What would they say? We've talked a lot about that community church approach that thinks that the church exists to satisfy absolutely every need anybody on this earth would have. You stop and think about it. That's what a lot of folks have of the church, and that is just any need I have, that the church ought to be that which satisfies that need. And the great thing is to take Christianity and have so many activities that it's a little bit more like a country club, but you know how have all that drinking and cussing and all that other stuff going on. And so we'll build a church, and here's what church is all about: a Christian country club. It's a whole lot better than the garden club that you might be a member of. I'm sure it's a whole lot better than the gated community. What do you call that? Power Association? What do they call them? Condo Comanches? Is that the way I've heard them described and everything? A whole lot more fun than that, you know. And is that what church is all about? Is it a place where, and you could just name a lot of the, but most often you'll talk about one of the byproducts of the church. I find that remarkable, that sometimes when situations come up, the only part of that situation that we see is the part that immediately impacts my life. And sometimes that's the way we think about the church. And that's not a wrong, and that's why I wouldn't, if you said the church is there so that as I get older and, you know, as I become a widower or a widow, the church is there so I can have family. Well, David did say he places the solitary in a family. And so that's not a wrong answer. And that's not where I'm trying to head, and that's not what this study is all about. Church is there so I can raise godly children. Yeah. Yeah, and that's not a wrong answer. Let me see if I can give you Jesus' answer. When Jesus came and started talking about the kingdom of heaven being at hand, you remember that Old Testament prophesied that there would be a descendant of David who would sit on David's throne? In the preaching of John the Baptist, Matthew 3:2, and Jesus, Matthew 4:17, and Jesus when he sends out the 12, Matthew 10:7, and Jesus when he sends out the 70, Luke chapter 10 and verse 9. Here's a message that went out: the kingdom is at hand, the kingdom is at hand, the kingdom is at hand. Wonder what they thought. What was their concept? What the kingdom was. And everybody's got their own concepts. Some of the concepts they had were obviously wrong. You remember that occasion whenever they, John chapter 6 and verse 15, they came to take Jesus and make him king by force. I mean, why wouldn't you want that kind of king? You don't like the weather? The king of your kingdom could say, "Peace be still," and man, it all changes. He's in charge of the weather. Been to the doctor lately? What about King Jesus? Every sick person they brought to King Jesus was healed. Isn't that amazing? Kingdom of heaven is at hand. I'm telling you, that's the kind of king that I want. And that part of it is really good. That part of it is something that is really, really important. But that's not what the kingdom is all about. What's it all about? Don't like the weather. Oh, don't like the Roman government? We'll take care of Rome. I mean, he who can call, you know, the legions of angels to protect himself, he got that same power, man. Rome will be out of here in a heartbeat. And some of them really thought that was what it was. That was one of their concerns and everything. And also it was a part of his popularity. What about paying your taxes? You know how King Jesus pays taxes? Go fishing. I think I'd like, some of you, I know some of you would really, really like that kind of a king. And the disciples just couldn't understand it. Right before he ascends into heaven, Lord, and listen to this, Acts 1:6, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Words have meaning. What does that mean? Restore means there's something that you had before and you're trying to build it again. And it's obvious that for several hundred years, there's not really been a kingdom of Israel. I mean, you get beyond the glorious time when King David is on the throne and whenever the early part of King Solomon's reign, when it's the greatest world power there is. But even in the time of the divided kingdom, they still had power and they were still influential whenever there were those righteous kings that were there. And God blessed them whenever they had those righteous kings. And it's very likely that they had a misunderstanding of the kingdom. I had recently a thought about maybe the devil had a misunderstanding of the kingdom. Whenever Satan tried to tempt Jesus, he tempted him by offering him what? All of the kingdoms of this world. That's an interesting concept. If I'm going to tempt him, I'm going to have to, we can make you king and you'll be king of all the kingdoms on this earth. That's not the kind of kingdom. How do you explain what the kingdom is? Now, that the kingdom and the church are the same, and so whenever we begin answering the question, why did the Lord establish His kingdom? We'll answer the question, why did the Lord establish the church? Look in Matthew 13. You might as well open your Bible. We're going to spend several minutes, at least a few minutes looking at Matthew chapter 13. And here's what we're trying to answer. What's church all about? When God, before the world began, understood that there someday would be this kingdom that is on this earth, what's it all about? And so in Matthew chapter 13, that is that occasion whenever that whole multitude is gathered together and Jesus gets in that boat and uses that boat as a pulpit area. And he spake many things unto them. And he says, a man went out and sowed seed. Okay, I got that. Now, if I've got that earthly view of the kingdom, or if I've got into these other views of the kingdom, I might not get it. I might not really understand what this is all about. You know the parable. You understand the parables. But whenever he said, a man went out and he sowed the seed. And as he sowed the seed, some fell by the wayside, and some on the stony ground, and some on the thorny ground, and some on the good soil. And you know what happened? The seed that fell on the wayside, the birds came and ate that. That's what would happen. Birds want seed. There it is. It's on that ground that's hard. There it is, just laying right there on the surface. Birds can get to it rather easily. The birds come and eat the seed. And then, that which fell among the thorns grew up, and it was good soil, but good soil grows good thorns. And so it choked out the good seed. And that which fell on the stony ground, that's that ground that has a little bit of dirt and not much depth, is the way it's described. When the sunshine came out, it all died. And then the other that fell among on good soil, 30, 60, and 100 fold. Now, walk away. You heard Jesus' sermon. And you've got that earthly kingdom view of what the kingdom is all about. Well, where'd you go? Well, I went and I heard Jesus. He's a remarkable person, you know. And what did he talk about? Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what he talked about. The best I can figure, he was talking about planting crops. Do you understand? If you don't have this explanation of this, that's where you'd be. It is remarkable that Jesus has the disciples to come to him. And when the disciples come to him, they said to him, what verse is that, about verse 10? Where he said, tell us, why do you talk in parables? And he says, it's given unto you to understand the mysteries of the kingdom. Hello? The source, what he just said, has something to do with the mysteries of the kingdom. And it does. Now, mystery is not something you'll ever solve. It's just something that had not yet been solved at this time. It's given unto you to understand these things. But then he says, starting, what's that? Well, verse 18. Here's the parable of the sower. And he explains it. Now, we don't have time to look at that verse in Mark chapter 4. But in Mark chapter 4, Jesus said, get this. If you don't understand this parable, the one about the sower, you will not be able to understand any of the parables. Wow. This must really be important. If I don't get this one, I can't do calculus until I can do addition and subtraction. Pluses and minuses. Can I just chase a rabbit for just a moment? Studying with a lady recently and talked, she brought up Revelation 22 verses 18 and 19 about you can't add to the Bible. And she says, and you also cannot minus. I loved her way of describing. Instead of taking away, it's plus or minus. But you can't do calculus if you don't do plus or minus. Wow, this is important then. And so he says, here's this parable. And then all of a sudden, in Mark he says, the seed that is being sown is the Word of God. Now stay here in Matthew, and whenever he explains the parable, he says, whenever anyone, this is in verse 19 of Matthew 13, when anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the wicked one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. Oh, we're not talking about dirt. This parable is about sowing the Word of God in hearts. Now, you and I understand this parable. But you don't know what a profound insight that is into trying to understand this parable. You just never would get it. And so he says, those birds, that's the devil. That's the wicked one. And you and I need to have an expectation. Not that perhaps it might happen every now and then, but an expectation that whenever the word is being sown that Satan is aware of, he's going to do everything he can to create circumstances so that that seed will not germinate. How powerful is that seed? Folks, that's hard dirt that's got seed on top of it. Yeah? But the devil recognizes the power that is in this word can penetrate the hardest of hearts. Have you ever seen grass growing up through cement? Especially asphalt. Just drive around our parking lot, you might want to. It just doesn't. Why? There's something powerful. You put that seed underneath and it's under the asphalt and everything, and all of a sudden it starts, I don't know how, you don't know how, and all of a sudden there's power in. What about the power in this seed? And that's what you and I need to understand. And so he goes out and he starts sowing this seed. And it represents different kind of hearts. We may talk about this a little bit later in some of the other studies, but not every place the seed is sown. That's not where you're going to. Not all soil is alike. We need to keep that in mind. But then he talks about another parable. And by the way, this is the parable of the tares. Vegetation, that weed that grew up that looked very much like the wheat that had been sown. And this time he adds another element to it, and it is a different parable. And you do not want to go overboard in combining parables. Each of them have their own distinct qualities and their distinct ability. But whenever you get to the parable of the tares, that parable starts in 24. The kingdom of heaven is like a man sowing good seed in the field. But while he slept, his enemy comes and sows these weeds, tares among the wheat, and goes his way. And so what you have is a situation where a man's gone out and he sowed the seed. I think it is ironic that the Lord explains the parable of the tares. Look down in verse 36. Jesus sent the multitudes away and went into the house, and his disciples came to him saying, "Would you explain this one? If you will put your mind where the minds of the disciples are, who are trying to figure out what the kingdom is all about, you wouldn't have a clue what this is all about. You absolutely would not." And so Jesus says in this parable that the field is the world. And in this world, he who sows the good seed, what's that, 37? Is the Son of Man. Can I tell you what the kingdom is like? Wait a minute. If the kingdom is the church, can I tell you what church is like? Two simple stories that the world has not fully understood. And so he says, Satan is active in this one also. The first parable is about just the word when it's sown generically, and the second one focuses more on what the life of Jesus sought to accomplish and what would be the one of the reasons the Son of Man came into this world, and that is to sow in this in this field, this seed. Look in verse 38. The field is the world, and the good seed are the children of God. Now you look at the seed, not as it's sown, because that which is sown, at least in that first parable, is the word of God. But you know what comes out of that? Coming out of the sowing of the seed is a child of God. Why did Jesus come into the world? You start answering that, and all of a sudden you begin focusing on answering the very question that we talked about, and that is, why did he build the church? And so now then, he's given them these parables. And so the other parables that he gives, have to back up, you know, because the parable, before he explains the parable of the tares, he mentions some other things that are there. And that's in verse 31. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. Isn't it amazing? How much he talks about seed? The kingdom of heaven is like mustard seed. And when it is sown, a man takes it and sows it in the field. And indeed, it's the least of all the seeds. But when it grows up, it's greater than the herbs. And it becomes a tree so much that that mustard plant over in that part of the world became a tree. And even birds could land in the branches of it. That's an indication of it. The kingdom, the church, is like the tiniest grain on this earth. The kingdom of heaven is like that. We need to have an appreciation of it. The power that's found whenever that seed is sown in the right place, it will grow and grow. Provided the heart is there, receptive. You look at the end of the life of Jesus, and what's the fruit of his life? I'm talking about before his resurrection. What's your life like, Jesus? I've done with my life everything God wanted me to do with my life. And so it's like that. Isn't that amazing? There's no explanation of that one. You get the parable of the tares, you get the parable of the sower, and all of a sudden you read about the kingdom of heaven is like that grain of mustard seed. I believe I can figure that out. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. And then the very next verse, couple of verses, what's that? Verse 33, the kingdom of heaven is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in 3 measures of meal till it was all leavened. And while planting a mustard seed might be appeal more to a masculine audience, everybody who's done any baking understands about leaven. And says the kingdom of heaven's like leaven. 2 pictures depicting something that is really, really much the same. Go beyond the explanation of that parable and go down to verse 44. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. Okay, treasures hidden in a field, that's not seed in the ground. That's not seed and the devil coming in sowing weeds. It's not like seed germinating or like leaven spreading. The kingdom of heaven like a treasure in a field. Guess that's indicating the worth of it, isn't it?
So, man, if you were teaching the 7 or 8 year old kids down here, up and down the hallway, and you said, the kingdom of heaven's like a treasure. What does that mean? What's a treasure? And they'd say, that's something that's like a pot of gold. It's worth a lot. Yeah. I mean, a child gets that. How much is the church worth? Gethsemane, Calvary, and skipping a few months beyond that, martyrdom. And so it's like this treasure. And the amazing thing is, and we have trouble understanding this because, you know, you've got all that gold and silver, and you've got it in a safe deposit box, or you got a gold certificate hidden somewhere. Back then, they didn't have banks. If they had banks, they might have been dishonest bankers. And so you might just take whatever treasure you had and put it out in the field. And then you got Alzheimer's. And the kids come to see you real often, but they said, Dad, you ever think about polluting in a garden? I think I'll just start digging back here in the backyard, you know. I mean, you understand, I'm making this up. It's remarkable, isn't it? You died and you've left a treasure. And somebody comes along later and lifts up the rock under which you've hidden your gold. And the field, not even sure who it belongs to, but somebody does, finds out the ownership, and he buys that field. And the point is not the rightness or wrongness of what that man's action. The point is, he found a treasure, and he did everything he could. Did everything he could to get that treasure. Now, you and I understand that. You think Les McQuinn doesn't understand what a treasure the church is? And all of us, if we haven't been at that place, will be at that. That all I've got in times of adversity is my brothers and my sisters. It doesn't necessarily have to be the death of somebody, just adversity. It's a treasure. But it's far more than just a treasure in that little pocket of my life. What is the church worth? You know this. Which he purchased with his blood. So you got a new car? What'd you pay for it? Don't mind if I ask, what'd you pay for it? Why? What you pay for it gives you some indication about what it's worth. I got a real bargain down. I got a blue light special. You know, Kmart sold all of their blue lights to Walmart, and I got a blue light special at Walmart. And let me tell you what I got. What'd you pay for it? What'd you pay for the church, Jesus? Pardon me. That's the treasure. Whatever value you put on the agonies of Gethsemane and the sweat dropping from him and his blood that was evidence of that blood-like sweat that was there in the garden, and all of the blood that is there at the scourging post, and all of the blood that is there that was there when they pressed the crown of thorns on his head, and all that happened, and all of the blood that dropped all the way to Golgotha, and all of the blood that puddled there at the foot of the cross. That's the treasure. And there's no way, guys, we can treat it secondarily. But we must understand the importance of the value in our own lives. Those things that are closest to us can so easily lose their value until they're gone. And then we really understand the worth of it. And so this man, verse 44, hidden in a field, and he finds it, and he goes and he gets it. I find the next parable interesting, because if I understand what Jesus is saying here, it I may be reading it different from the way somebody else read it. Again, in verse 45, the kingdom of heaven is like a man seeking beautiful pearls. The kingdom of heaven, the previous one, is like a treasure. But this verse does not say that the kingdom of heaven is like a pearl. The kingdom of heaven is like the man that is seeking pearls. And he looks, and he looks, can't find them. And all of a sudden, this man seeking pearls finds a pearl, and he invests everything he owns in gaining that pearl. The emphasis here is not on the worth of the treasure in the field. The emphasis in this parable is on the picture of the man's activities trying to find the pearl. We might come back to this a little bit later, but let me just ask you in passing, what's worth more than anything else in this world? And do you have to look through a lot of pearls before you find the pearl of a great price? And then he says, the kingdom of heaven, verse 47, is like a net that's cast out into the sea. And they gathers in some of every kind. And when it was full, they bring it to shore, and they sat down and gather the good into the vessel, and they throw the bad away. And then this one is explained also, so we won't misunderstand it. So it'll be at the end of the age. The angels will come and separate the wicked from the just and cast them into the furnace of fire, and there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said to them, have you understood all these things? And they said, yes, Lord. Let me ask you, have you understood all these things? That's what Jesus did. He got to the end of his sermon. Now you understand what we're talking about? Why did the Lord establish the church? We don't have time to spend a lot of time here, but would you look in Romans chapter 10? Romans chapter 10 quotes a verse from Joel, and it's quoted elsewhere. It's quoted on the day of Pentecost. But Romans chapter 10 says this, starting in verse 13. Whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. How shall they call on him in whom they've not believed? That's obvious. Sometimes people say, well, the moment you believe, that's what calling on the Lord is. No, no, no. It's separate action. Once you believe, then you can call on the name of the Lord. And then the statement is, how shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? That's not the same action. Belief is one thing, hearing is another. And then this next statement, and how shall they hear without a preacher? And then verse 15, and how shall they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things. Stop there for a minute. Is the church involved at all in the salvation of men calling on the name of the Lord? Is not the church inside Romans 10? When you're talking about that individual that is teaching and that individual that is supporting those who are teaching, is this not a picture of the very reason that God had in mind whenever the Old Testament, Joel chapter 2, whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved? And in Romans chapter 10, by the way, in the verses we did not read, go back up to verse 12, and there's no distinction, Jew and Gentile. Jews, you want to be saved? You want to be added to the church? You want to be added to the kingdom? Then here's the process. It starts with somebody hearing a message from a teacher. And the end result of that is, hopefully, that faith will be produced. And the results of having faith is individuals calling on the Lord, and the results of calling on the Lord is salvation. Let me ask you this. Where do you fit in this? Where do we fit in this? And so for the next several weeks, that's going to be our emphasis, is to try to help each one of us become aware of where we fit in this picture. Not everybody can lead singing. I don't know if Heath is here tonight. Heath's become he placed membership here, 6 months ago? Is that your remembrance when Heath placed membership here and all of the energy that guy's got? And wow, does he ever have a bad day? Could I just tell you in passing, he's the airline steward. We had a visitor here the other Sunday night, I guess it was a Sunday night. She came, Sunday morning it was, and she came in, a visitor. She was an airline stewardess, and she said to Heath, I know you. And he says, well, I'm not working for American or whoever it was he's working for then. Maybe it was Delta he worked with at one time, and that's when their paths had crossed. And standing beside them, I said, no, he's working for United. I said, he's the one that pulled the man off the plane at United. And people who know me know I'm never serious. And I thought I thought this visitor would understand I was joking. And she looked at Heath and said, Heath, did you do that? In case you're wondering, the answer is no. Okay. But you and I, you see, need to understand that not everybody can fly an airplane. Not everybody can clean up puke bags. But I'm telling you, if Delta doesn't have some puke bag cleaners uppers, Delta's in trouble. Where do you fit in this? Well, I'm just a wheel changer. Well, okay. Is that important? To be the guy who changes the wheels on the plane? How'd you like to be sitting on a plane that's about ready to take off, and you think of the force that's on those tires whenever they try to land that plane? You want brand new tires there. And you look down there, and that thing's as slick as it can be, and the cords that run inside the wheels, the cords are shining through. Well, what I do is not that important. Where do you fit in this? What is it that you can do? Let me see if I can say it this way. I'm not going to hear the bells ring, am I? Have the second bell rung? Yeah. What?
There are no bells.
There are no bells. Good. Now look at verse. Where do you fit in this? That's where we're headed. And so I'll be in a lectureship in Ohio next Wednesday, and David will be talking. He's going to talk about how Jesus took interest in people that were not even people that anybody else would take interest in. Is he really our example? Where do we fit in God's eternal purpose?